Star Tide Rising, Cassette 9.
When he awakened next to the warm coals of his fire, the dawn was barely breaking, casting long, dim shadows along the beach. Tom felt much better. His stomach had become resigned to a fast, and sleep had done him a lot of good. He was still weak, but he felt ready to try a dash for the next possible haven. He got up, brushed off the multicolored sand, and peered to the north. Yes, the floating derelict was still there. Hope on the horizon. To his left, under the massive bulkhead, the Thenanin scout breathed softly, slowly dying. It had fallen asleep listening to Tom's story of the shallow cluster, of the shining giant ships, and the mysterious symbols on their sides. Tom doubted the creature would ever reawaken. He was about to turn and pick up the shoes he had woven the night before, when he frowned and peered under a shading hand toward the eastern horizon. If only the binoculars had been saved. He squinted, and at last he made out a line of shadows moving slowly against the brightening horizon, spindly-legged figures, and one smaller, shambling thing. A column of tiny silhouettes moved slowly northward. Tom shivered. They were headed toward the eggshell wreck. Unless he acted quickly, they would cut him off from his only chance at survival. And he could tell already that they were Tandu. Part 6. Scatter. The moot point is whether Leviathan can long endure so wide a chase and so remorseless a havoc, and the last whale, like the last man, smoke his last pipe, and then himself evaporate in the final puff. Herman Melville. Chapter 64. Crydike Sowed. Crydike stared at the hollow display and concentrated. It was easier to talk than to listen. He could call up the words one or two at a time, speak them slowly, shuttling them like pearls on a string. Neural link repaired by Jillian and McKinney. But speech still gone. Sout's image nodded. You can use tools now, though. Crydike concentrated on Sout's simple question. You can use... Each word was clear, its meaning obvious, but in a row they meant nothing. It was frustrating. Sout switched to trinary. Tools to prod, the balls, the starships. Is your jaw the player, the pilot? Crydike nodded. That was much better, though even trinary came to him like a foreign tongue, with difficulty. Spider walkers, walkers, walkers. Holocom talkers, talkers, talkers. Are my playthings, are... Crydike averted his eyes. He knew there were elements of primal in that simple phrase, in the repetition and high whistling. It was humiliating to still have an active, able mind, and know that to the outside world you sounded retarded. At the same time, he wondered if Sao noticed a trace of the language of his dreams, the voices of the old gods. Listening to the captain, Sao was relieved. Their first conversation had started off well, but toward the end, Crydike's attention had begun to wander, especially when Sout had started running him through a battery of linguistic tests. Now, after McKinney's last operation, he seemed much more attentive. He decided to test Crydike's listening ability by telling him about his discovery. He carefully and slowly explained in trinary about the singing he had heard while linked to the robot in the drill tree funnel. Crydike looked confused for a long moment as he concentrated on Sout's slow, simplified explanation. Then he seemed to understand. In fact, from his expression, it seemed he thought it the most natural thing in the world that a planet should sing. Link. Link me. Please. I will... Listen. Listen. Sao clapped his jaw in assent, pleased. Not that Krydike, with his language centers burned, would be able to make out anything but static. It took all of Sao's subtle training and experience to trace the refrain, except for that one time when the voices from below had shouted in apparent anger. The sounds had been almost amorphous. He still shuddered, remembering that one episode of lucidity.
"Okay, Krydike," he said, as he made the connection. "Listen closely."
Krydike's eyes recessed in concentration as the static crackled and popped over the line. Chapter 65. Jillian.
Triple damn! Well, we can't wait for her to get here to start the move. It might take Hikahi 2 days to circle around in the skiff. I want to have Streaker safely inside the seahorse by then.
Suessi's simulacrum shrugged.
Well, you could leave her a note.
Jillian rubbed her eyes.
That's just what we'll do. We'll drop a monofilament relay link at Streaker's present position, so we can stay in touch with the party on the island. I'll stick a message to the relay telling her where we've gone.
What about Toshio and Denny?
Jillian shrugged.
I'd hope to send the skiff after them and Sao, and maybe after Tom. But as things are, I'd better have Denny and Sao head toward your site by sled. I hate doing it. It's dangerous, and I need Toshio there watching Takata Jim until just before we take off.
She didn't mention the other reason for wanting Toshio to stay as long as possible. They both knew that Tom Orley, if he flew the glider home, would return to the island. He ought to have someone waiting for him.
"Are we really going to abandon Metz and Takata Jim?"
Suessi looked perplexed.
"And Charlie Dart, apparently. He stowed away on the longboat, yes. It's their choice. They hope to make it home after the Galactics blow us to Kingdom Come. And for all I know, they may be right. Anyway, the final decision's Hikahi's when she finally shows up and finds out she's in command."
Jillian shook her head.
"Ifni sure seems to have gone out of her way to throw us curves, hasn't she, Hannes?"
The elderly engineer smiled.
"Luck's always been fickle. That's why she's a lady."
But Jillian didn't have the energy to give him much of a dirty look. A light winked on the console next to the holo display.
"Here it is, Hannes. The engine room is ready. I've got to go now. We're getting underway."
"Good luck, Jillian."
Suessi held up an O sign, then broke the connection. Jillian flicked a switch, cutting into the comm line from Streaker to the island.
"Sao, this is Jillian. Sorry to break in, but would you please tell the captain we're about to move?"
It was a courtesy to let Krydike know. Streaker had been his once.
"Yes, Jillian."
There was a series of high, repetitious whistles in very primal-like trinary. Much of it crested over the upper range of even Jillian's gene-enhanced hearing.
"The captain wants to go outside to watch,"
Saud said.
"He promises not to get in the way."
Jillian couldn't see any reason to refuse.
"All right, but tell him to check with Watasetti first, to use a sled and to be careful. We won't be able to spare anyone to go chasing him if he wanders off."
There was another high series of whistles that Jillian could barely follow. Krydike signaled that he understood.
"Oh, by the way, Sao," Jillian added, "please ask Toshio to call me as soon as the longboat arrives."
"Yes."
Jillian cut the connection and got up to dress.
There were so many things to juggle simultaneously. I wonder if I did the right thing, letting Charlie Dart sneak away, she thought. If he or Takata Jim behave in a way I don't expect, what'll I do? A tiny light shone at the corner of her console. The NIS machine still wanted to talk to her. The light didn't flash urgent. Jillian decided to ignore it as she hurried out to supervise the move. Chapter 66 Aki. With aching muscles, Aki swam slowly out of the notch in which he had rested until dawn. He took several deep breaths and dove, scattering a school of brightly scaled fish-like creatures through shafts of morning light. Without thinking, he speared through the school and snapped up a large one, relishing its frantic struggle between his jaws. But the metal taste was bitter. He flipped the creature away, spitting. Red clouds spread a pink glow across the east as he surfaced again. Hunger growled in his compound stomachs. He wondered if the sound was loud enough to be picked up by his hunter. It's unfair. When Katha John finds me, he, at least, will have something to eat. Aki shook himself. What a bizarre thought. You're falling apart, Mitty. Katha John is no cannibal. He's a... A what? Aki remembered the final stretch yesterday at sunset, when he had somehow made it to the chain of metal mounds just meters ahead of his pursuer. The chase amidst the tiny islands had been a confusion of bubbles and surf and hunting cries. For hours after he had finally found a hiding place, he had listened to staccato bursts of sonar that proved Katha John had not gone far. Thought of the bosun sent chills down Aki's spine. What kind of creature was he? It wasn't just the irrationality of this death chase. There was something else as well, something in the way Katha John hunted. The giant sonar sweeps contained something malevolent that made Aki want to curl up in a ball. Of course, Stenos gene grafts might account for some of his size and irritability, but in Katha John there was more. Something very different must have gone into the bosun's genetic splice. Something terrifying. Something Aki, raised on Calathea, had never encountered. Aki swam close to the edge of the coral mound and stuck his jaw out beyond the northern verge. There were only the natural sounds of the Kithrip Sea. He hopped up on his tail and scanned visually. To go west or north? To Hikahi or Toshio? Better north. This chain of mounds might extend to the one where the encampment lay. It might provide cover. He dashed across the quarter-kilometer gap to the next island, then listened quietly. There was no change. Breathing a little more easily, he crossed the next channel, then the next, swimming quick bursts, then listening, then resuming his cautious passage. Once he heard a strange, complex chatter to his right. He lay motionless until he realized that it couldn't be Katha John. He detoured slightly to take a look. It was an underwater skirmish line of balloon-like creatures with distended air bladders and lively blue faces. They carried crude implements and nets filled with thrashing prey. Except for a few holos sent back by Denny Sudman and Saut, this was Aki's first glimpse of the Kithrip natives, the Kikwi. He watched, fascinated, then swam toward them. He had thought himself still far south of Toshio, but if this group was the same... As soon as they caught sight of him, the hunters squeaked in panic. Dropping their nets, they scrambled up the vine-covered face of a nearby island. Aki realized that he must have encountered a different tribe, one which had never seen dolphins before. Still, seeing them was something. He watched the last one climb out of sight. Then he turned northward once more.
but when he passed the northern shore of the next mound, a sharp beam of sound passed over him. Aki quailed. How? Had Cathajan duplicated his logic about an island chain, or had some demon instinct told him where to hunt his prey? The eerie call passed over him once more. It had mutated further during the night into a piercing, falling cry that set Aki shivering. The cry pealed again, nearer, and Aki knew he couldn't hide. That cry would seek him out in any cleft or cranny until the panic took hold. He had to make a break for it while he still had control over his mind.
Chapter 67 Kipiru. The fight had begun in the pre-dawn darkness. A few hours ago, Kipiru realized that his pursuer's sled was showing no sign of failing. The engine screamed, but it would not die. Kipiru notched his own upward well beyond the red line, but it was too late. A short time later, he heard the whine of a torpedo homing in from behind. He zigged leftward and down, blowing ballast to leave a cloud of noisy bubbles in his wake. The torpedo streaked past and into the gloom beyond. An amplified squawk of disappointment and indignation echoed amongst the rills and seamounts. Kipiru was used to hearing primal obscenities from his pursuer. He had almost reached the line of metal mounds before which the two swimming dolphins had disappeared a few hours back. As he had drawn nearer, Kipiru had listened to the distant hunt cries and been chilled by a gnawing association that he couldn't bring himself yet to believe. It made him dread for Aki. Now Kipiru had his own problems. He wished Aki luck holding out until he could get rid of this idiot on his own tail. It was growing light overhead. Kipiru dove his sled behind a lumpy ridge, then throttled the engine back and waited. Moki cursed as the tiny torpedo failed to detonate. Teeth. Teeth are better. Better than things. He swung his jaw left and right. He had abandoned the sled sensors and was controlling the machine purely by habit. Where was the smart aleck? Let him come out and get it over with. Moki was tired and cranky and unutterably bored. He had never imagined that being a great bull could be so tedious. Moki wanted the hot, almost orgasmic rage back. He tried to call up the bloodlust again, but kept thinking about killing fish, not dolphins. If only he could emulate the savagery he had heard in Cathajan's hunt cry. Moki no longer hated the frightening bosun. He had begun to see the giant as a spirit creature of pure and evil nature. He would kill this smart-aleck tersiops and bring its head to Cathajan as proof of his worthiness as a disciple. Then he, too, would become elemental, a terror that none would ever dare thwart. Moki brought the machine about in a circle, keeping close to the seafloor to take advantage of shadows of sound. The tersiops had turned left at high speed. His turn had to be wider than Moki's, so all Moki had to do was hunt in the correct arc. Moki had been on guard duty when this chase began, so his sled had torpedoes. He was sure the smartass didn't have any. He whistled in eager anticipation of an end to the tedious chase. A sound. He turned so quickly he banged his snout against the plastic bubble dome. Moki gunned the sled forward, readying another torpedo. This one would finish his enemy off. A sheer drop opened into a broad ocean canyon. Moki took ballast and fell, hugging the wall. He throttled back and stopped. Minutes passed as the sound of muffled engines grew louder from his left. The oncoming sled was staying close to the cliff face at a greater depth. Suddenly it was below him. Moki chose not to fire right away. This was too easy. Let the smart aleck hear death
suddenly fall upon him from behind, too close to evade. Let him writhe in panic before Moki's torpedo tore his body into pieces. His sled growled, then dropped in pursuit. His victim could never turn in time. Moki crowed. A herd bull is a great bull. Moki interrupted his chant. Why wasn't the smart aleck fleeing? He had been relying entirely upon sound. Only now did he turn his eye on his intended victim. The other sled was empty. It drove along slowly, unpiloted. But then where? Hunting ears can make a bull, but eyes and brains make spacemen. The voice was above him. Moki cried out, trying to turn the sled and fire a torpedo at the same time. With a despairing wail, the engine screamed and then died. His neural link went dead just as he came about into sight of a sleek, gray tersiops dolphin, 2 meters above him, white teeth shining in the light from the surface. And fools make only corpses. Moki screamed as the cutting torch on the pilot's harness exploded into laser blue brilliance. Chapter 68. Tom Orley. Where did they all come from? Tom Orley hid behind a low weed mound and looked about at the various alien parties on the horizon. He counted at least 3 groups, all converging from different directions on the floating eggshell-shaped wreck. About a mile behind him, the volcano still rumbled. He had left the crashed Thenanin scout ship at dawn, leaving a pan of precious fresh water under the dying pilot's mouth, within reach if he should ever awaken. He had set out soon after sighting the party of Tandu, testing his newly woven weed shoes on the uneven, slimy surface. The splayed snowshoe-like devices helped him walk cautiously across the slick carpet of vines. At first, he moved much faster than the others, but soon the Tandu developed a new technique. They stopped floundering in the mire and came on at a brisk walk. Tom kept low and worried about what would happen if they caught sight of him. And now, there were other parties as well, one approaching from the southwest and one from the west. He couldn't make them out clearly yet, just dots bobbing slowly and with difficulty on a long, serrated horizon. But where the hell had they all come from? The Tandu were closest. There were at least 8 or 9 of them approaching in a column. Each creature splayed its 6 spindly legs wide apart to spread its weight. In their arms they cradled long, glistening instruments that could only be weapons. They marched forward rapidly. Tom wondered what their new tactic was. Then he noticed that the lead Tandu did not carry a weapon. Instead, it held the leash of a shaggy, shambling creature. The keeper leaned forward over its charge, as if coaxing it to keep at a given task. Tom risked raising his head a couple of feet above the mound. Well, I'll be damned. The hairy creature was creating land, or at least solidity, in a narrow causeway in front of the party. Just before and on both sides of the trail, there was a faint shimmering where reality seemed to struggle against a noxious intrusion. An apesiarch! Momentarily, Tom forgot his predicament, grateful for this rare sight. As he watched, the causeway failed in one spot. The luminous band around the edges of the trail snapped together with a loud bang. The Tandu warrior standing there flailed and thrashed as it fell into the weeds. By fighting, it merely tore the carpet and opened the hole wider, until finally it sank like a stone into the sea. None of the other Tandu seemed to take notice. The 2 behind the gap leaped across to the temporarily solid ground beyond. The party, diminished by one, continued to advance. Tom shook his head. He had to reach the wreck first. He couldn't afford to let the Tandu pass him. Yet if he did anything, even resumed his own march, they'd certainly spot him. He didn't doubt their efficiency with those weapons they carried. No human warrior ever underestimated the Tandu for long. Reluctantly, he knelt and untied the fastenings on his weed shoes. Discarding them, he crawled carefully to the edge of an open pool. He counted slowly, waiting until he could hear the column of galactics approaching, rehearsing his moves in his mind. Taking several deep breaths, he pulled his diving mask over his face, making certain it was snug and the collecting fins were clear. Then he pulled his needler from its holster, holding it in two hands. Tom set his feet on two firm roots and checked his balance. The pool was just in front of him. He closed his eyes. Listen for the swishing tail of the tiger shark. His empathy sense pinpointed the powerful psi emissions of the mad E.T. adept, now only some 80 meters away. Jillian, he sighed. Then, in one sudden fluid motion, he stood up and extended his weapon. His eyes opened, and he fired. Chapter 69 Toshio. Against Toshio's objections, they had used the last of the longboat's energy to lift it to a landing site on top of the island. He had offered to blast a wider opening into the chamber below the metal mound, but Takata Jim had turned his suggestion down cold. That meant 2 hours of back-breaking work, heaping chopped foliage over the small ship to camouflage it. Toshio wasn't sure even that would do any good if the Galactics finished their battle and turned their full attention to the planet's surface. Metz and Dart were supposed to help him. Toshio had set them to work cutting brush, but found that he had to tell them to do each and every thing. Dart was sullen and angry at being commanded by a middy he had ordered around only days before. He obviously wanted to get to the supplies he had excitedly dropped by the drill tree pool before being drafted into the work crew. Metz had been willing enough, but was so anxious to be off talking to Denny that he was distracted and worse than useless. Toshio finally sent them both away and finished the job by himself. At last, the boat was covered. He slumped to the ground and rested against the bole of an ollie nut tree. Damn Takata Jim! Toshio and Denny were supposed to see the encampment secure, report their findings on the Kikwi to Metz, and then climb on their sleds and get out of here. Jillian expected them to set out in a few hours, and yet almost nothing was accomplished. To top it all off, Streaker had only warned him an hour or so in advance that he could probably expect a stowaway. Jillian decided not to have Charlie arrested for violation of orders, even though it appeared he had stolen equipment from at least a dozen labs aboard the ship. Toshio was glad to be spared the added chore. There wasn't much of anything hereabouts to use as a jail, anyway. Foliage rustled to Toshio's left. A series of mechanical whirrings accompanied the sound of crushing vegetation. Then four spiders pushed through the brush to enter his tiny clearing. A Stenos dolphin lay on the flotation pad of each armored mechanical, controlling the four high-jointed legs with neural link commands. Toshio stood up as they approached. Takata Jim passed by, eyeing him coolly, silently. The other three spiders followed him across the clearing and back into the forest. The Stenos piped to each other in gutter trinary. Toshio stared after them. He discovered that he had been holding his breath. I don't know about Takata Jim, but those Fen with him
are crazier than at-last peer nesters, he said to himself, shaking his head. He had met few so-called Stenos on Calafia. Some had displayed quirks, positive and negative, like Saud, but none had ever had the look that the former vice-captain's followers had in their eyes. The sound of the procession faded away. Toshio got up to his feet. He wondered why Jillian had let Takata Jim go at all. Why not just throw him and his cohorts in the brig and have done with it? Granted, it was a good idea to leave a party with the longboat to try to sneak back to Earth if Streaker was lost trying to escape. Jillian probably couldn't spare any of the reliable members of the crew, but he turned toward the village of the Kikwi, thinking as he walked. Of course the longboat was stripped. Theoretically, Takata Jim couldn't contact the Galactics, even if he wanted to. And Toshio couldn't imagine a reason he'd want to. But what if he had a reason? And what if he found a way? Toshio almost bumped into a tree in his worried concentration. He looked up and corrected his path. I'll just have to make sure, he decided. Tonight, I'll have to find out if he can cause trouble. Tonight. The tribe's adults squatted around a circle in a clearing in the center of the village. Ignacio Metz and Denny Sudman sat to one side. The nest mother squatted across from them, her bright green and red striped puffer sacks fully inflated. The elders on either side of her billowed and chuffed like a chain of gaily painted balloons in the forest-filtered sunshine. Toshio stopped at the edge of the village clearing. Sunshine filtered through the trees, revealing a conclave of races. The Kikwi nest mother chattered, waving her paws in a queer up-and-down pattern that Denny had said connoted happy emphasis. If the oldest female had been angry, her gestures would have been crosswise. It was a blissfully simple expression pattern. The rest of the tribe repeated her sounds, sometimes anticipating her in a rising and falling chant of consensus. Ignacio Metz nodded excitedly, cupping one hand over an earphone as he listened to the translation computer. When the chant died down, he spoke a few words into a microphone. A long series of high-pitched, repetitive squeaks came out of the machine's speaker. Denny's expression was one of relief. She had dreaded the uplift specialist's first meeting with the Kikwi. But Metz had not, apparently, muffed her long and careful negotiations with the pre-sentients. The meeting seemed to be coming to a satisfactory conclusion. Denny caught sight of Toshio and smiled brilliantly. Without ceremony, she stood up and left the circle. She hurried over to where he waited at the edge of the village clearing. "How's it going?" he asked.
"Wonderfully. It turns out he's read every word I sent back. He understands their pack protocol, their physical manifestations of sex and age, and he thought my behavioral analysis was exemplary. Exemplary!"
Toshio smiled, sharing her pleasure.
"He's talking about getting me an appointment as a fellow at the Uplift Center. Can you imagine that?"
Denny couldn't help bouncing up and down excitedly.
"What about the treaty?" "Oh, they're ready any time. If Hikahi makes it here in the skiff, we'll take a dozen Kikwi back to Streaker with us. Otherwise, a few will go back to Earth with Metz in the longboat. It's all settled."
Toshio looked back at the happy villagers and tried not to show his misgivings. Of course, it was for the good of the Kikwi as a species. They would fare far better under the patronage of mankind than under almost any other starfaring race, and Earth geneticists had to have living beings to examine before any sort of adoption claim could be made. Every attempt would be made to keep the first group of aboriginals healthy. Half of Denny's job had been to analyze their bodily requirements, including needed trace elements. But it was still unlikely any of the first group would survive. Even if they did, Toshio doubted the Kikui had a notion of the strangeness they were about to embark upon. They're not sentients yet, he reminded himself. By galactic law, they're still animals, and unlike anyone else in the five galaxies, we'll at least try to explain to their limited understanding and ask permission. But he remembered a stormy night with driving rain and flashing lightning when the little amphibians had huddled around him and an injured dolphin who was his friend, keeping them warm and warding off despair with their company. He turned away from the sun-washed clearing.
"Then there's nothing keeping you here any longer?" he asked Denny.
She shook her head.
"I'd rather stay a while longer, of course. Now that I'm finished with the Kikui, I can really work on the problem of the metal mound. That's why I was so grouchy a couple of days ago. Besides being so tired trying to do two major jobs, I was also frustrated. But now we're a step closer to solving that problem. And did you know the core of the metal mound is still alive? It's..."
Toshio had to interrupt to stop the flow of words.
"Denny, stop it for a minute, please. Answer my question. Are you ready to leave now?"
Denny blinked. She changed tracks, frowning.
"Is it Streaker? Has something gone wrong?" "They began to move a few hours ago. I want you to gather all of your notes and samples and secure them to your sled. You and Saud are leaving in the morning."
She looked at him, his words slowly sinking in.
"You mean you, me and Saud, don't you?"
"No, I'm staying for another day. I have to."
"But why?"
"Look, Denny, I can't talk about it now. Just do as I ask, please."
As he turned to walk back toward the drill tree pool, she grabbed his arm. Holding on, she was forced to follow.
"But we were going to go together. If you have things to do here, I'll wait for you."
He walked along without answering. He couldn't think of anything to say. It was bitter to win her respect and affection at last, only to lose her within hours. "If this is what being grown up means, they can have it," he thought. "It sucks." As they approached the pool, sounds of loud argument came from that direction. Toshio hurried. Denny trotted alongside until they burst into the clearing. Charles Dart screamed and clutched at a slender cylinder that was gripped at the other end by the manipulator arm of Takata Jim's spider. Charlie strained against the pull of the Waldo machine. Takata Jim grinned, open-mouthed. The tug-of-war lasted for a few seconds as the Neo-Chimp's powerful muscles strained. Then the cylinder popped out of his hands. He fell back to the dust and barely stopped before rolling into the pool. He hopped up and shrieked his anger. Toshio saw three other Stenos-controlled spiders trooping off toward the longboat. Each carried another of the thin cylinders. Toshio stopped in his tracks when he got a good look at the one Takata Jim had taken. His eyes went wide.
"There is no longer any danger," Takata Jim told him.
His voice carried insouciance.
"I have confiscated these. They'll be kept safe aboard my boat, and there will be no harm."
"They're mine, you thief!"
Charles Dart hopped angrily, and his hands fluttered.
"You criminal," he growled. "You think I don't know you tried to murder Crydike? We all know you did. You wrecked the buoys to destroy the evidence, and now you steal the tools of my trade."
"Which you stole from Streaker's armory, no doubt, or... do you wish to call Dr. Baskin for confirmation that they truly are yours?"
Dart growled and showed an impressive display of teeth. He whirled away from the Neo-Dolphin and sat down in the dust in front of a complex diving robot, freshly unpacked on the verge of the pool. Takata Jim's spider started to turn, but the Finn noticed Toshio looking at him. For just a moment,
Dakota Jim's cool reserve broke under the youth's fierce gaze. He looked away, and then back at Toshio.
"Don't believe everything you hear, boy human," he said. "Much I have done and will do, and I'm convinced I am right. But it was not I who hurt Krydike."
"Did you destroy the buoys?"
Toshio could sense Denny standing close behind him, watching the large dolphin silently over his shoulder.
"Yes, but it was not I who set the trap. Like King Henry with Becket, I only found out about it after. Tell this on Earth, if by some strange chance you should escape, and I don't. Another took the initiative."
"Who did it, then?"
Toshio's fists were tight balls. A long sigh escaped Takata Jim's blowmouth.
"Our Dr. Metz wrung from the survey board berths for some who shouldn't have been on this voyage. He was impatient. A few of his stenos had unusual family trees."
"The stenos?"
"A few stenos. I am not one of Metz's experiments. I am a starship officer. I earn my place."
The dolphin's voice was defiant.
"When the pressure built to the breaking point, some of them turned to me. I thought I could control them, but there was one who turned out to be more than even I could manage. Tell them if you go home, Toshio Iwishika, tell them on Earth that it's possible to turn a dolphin into a monster. And they should be warned."
Takata Jim gave him one long, intent look. Then his spider turned away and followed his crew back to the longboat.
"He's a liar,"
Denny whispered after he had gone.
"He sounds so reasonable and logical, but I shiver when I listen to him."
Toshio watched the spider disappear down the trail.
"No," he said. "He is ambitious and maybe crazy, too. He's probably a traitor as well, but for some reason, I think everything he said was explicitly true. Maybe a surface honesty is what he clings to now, for pride's sake."
He turned, shaking his head.
"Not that that makes him any less dangerous."
He approached Charles Dart, who looked up with a friendly smile. Toshio squatted near the chimp planetologist.
"Dr. Dart, how big were they?"
"Were what, Toshio? Say, have you seen this new robot? I made it up special. It can dive to the base of the shaft, then dig laterally to those big magma tunnels we detected."
"How big were they, Charlie?"
Toshio demanded. He was tense and ready to throttle the chimpanzee.
"Tell me."
Dart glanced briefly, guiltily, at Toshio, then looked down at the pool wistfully.
"Only about a kiloton each," he sighed. "Hardly big enough to set off decent crust waves, really."
He looked up with large, innocent brown eyes.
"They were really only teeny little A-bombs. Honest."
This ends Side 1 of Cassette 9.